Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Dragoncast. Home of House of the Dragon. Gather your small council, send out your ravens and call in your bannermen. I'm Hand of the King, Jamie East, here to guide you through the highly anticipated return to Westeros. Hello and welcome to Dragoncast, home of House of the Dragon. I'm your host and maester of ceremonies, Jamie East, and joining me this week for our regular roundup of all things hot D are, as always, journalist, writer, and the adorable sock puppet on the Hand of the King, Chris Mandel. How's it going, Chris?
I'm good, yeah, I'm good.
And this week's special guest is a Game of Thrones fanatic, a History of War enthusiast, TV presenter and comedy legend to boot. It's the Governor himself, it's Mr. Al Murray. Al, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm desperate to talk to people about this whole show.
Yeah. So have you found the series? Obviously, you're a long-time friend of Thronecast. You've been on a few times. We've spoken loads about it.
Well, I'm finding it so intense, I have to sort of watch it in 20-minute chunks and then kind of cool off. Certainly not this episode, but the episode before, I actually had to do that because I was finding the sort of the machinations and the, you know, manifestations of the plot and the scenes in episode 8, you know, the king revealing his illness to its full extent. Daemon bringing summary justice with his righteous sword and all that sort of stuff. All of that, the sheer high drama of it. And I had to watch that one in 20-minute nuggets because it was just too much.
Just a bit too stressful.
It's too stressful, too full attention. But then, of course, the endless problem, it was always Game of Thrones' problem, but it's clearly a thing they've decided to address in this is, how'd you top last week? And so...
quite an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, I think... We were talking about it just before we hit record, is that, you know, episode 9 is traditionally in Thronesland, but, you know, we've had Ned's death, we've had the Red Wedding, the Battle of Blackwater, all of those kind of ones. So I think they've purposely tried to break that mold because otherwise, I mean, you're just setting yourself up for such a massive kind of like, you're not doing yourselves any favours by continually doing that, are you really?
No, those episodes always were, here the plot goes, changes, you know, here comes the next striation of the plot, the next major... layer of the lasagna, and this has that. This is that. Because the king has died, and it's the consequences of it. I mean, and I think the way it's all handled is, I mean, you know me, Jamie. I'm an absolute sucker for this universe and this show and the way it's put together and the way it portrays power. It directly injects it into me. It's just too good. It's too exciting.
Yeah, it is. Right, before we get stuck into to episode 9, just want to say, here's your weekly reminder. If you're enjoying the podcast, do like, subscribe, comment and share with your mates who might be interested. It really does make a massive difference. And one day the gods will reward you for it. And I'm really sorry I hadn't had time to reply to everybody that's been in touch this week. We had such a phenomenal response to our Paddy interview last week. Literally, I've got about 1,000 emails that I haven't replied to. Answer very quick questions. No, I can't ask Paddy that. B, I think he's pretty much done. He did an Instagram post soon after that where he thanked people for their comments and kind words about it. And then I think he ended that by saying, now, no more. So I think there might be a little bit of the Sean Bean about it where it's just like, guys, Ned's dead, Viserys is dead, let's move on.
Yeah.
But I will, of course, get in touch with you. And next week for our final House of the Dragon season 1 episode, just to give you a heads up, we've got some great giveaways, actually. HarperCollins have been in touch. And to my left on the floor, I've got a plethora of George R. R. Martin, Dragons, Thrones goodies to give away next week. So do stick around and come back next week and find out how to win that. Right. Let's get on to episode 9, The Green Council. Now, hands up. for the first couple of minutes where the piano music was playing and the king was dead and there was the whispering along the corridors and great moment where Alison kind of genuine heartfelt tears from Alison, I thought, was anyone else thinking, was this what it was like in Balmoral a couple of weeks ago? I know it's a bit, I was genuinely interested because, you know, kind of crossing over into the real world when... We now know that Queen Elizabeth II died at 12:30 in the afternoon. And yet, when we were all watching it unfold on the news, you know, they were kind of keeping it going and obviously not announcing it. I don't think it was announced till 4:00. We saw Harry, Andrew and William all getting in there. They all knew at that time that they were, you know, I just found it all fascinating that's clearly how it works. And the machine kind of literally starts kicking into action from the second that the monarch takes their final breath.
I wonder if they recut it. I wonder if they shot a little bit extra. I wonder if, you know, with events having... Because after all, surely not, but maybe they did because that sort of lingering thing, you could have easily started with, what do you mean he's dead? You know, Alicent being told straight from there. But to have the kind of... That kind of... I mean, they're very good at delayed gratification on this show anyway. So there was a bit of that going on. But yes, it does make you wonder. It does, and also just the entire sort of vacuum of the whole episode. The whole episode, the vacuum, trying to trace the heir. You know, where is he? You know, all this sort of stuff. He's not stuck on the M56, is he? In his chauffeur-driven Range Rover.
I wanted to talk about that, really. That was the main kind of plot point throughout this whole thing. Chris, what was your take on that? Was that... So what I took from that was that you had Otto and Alison, whose relationship has now kind of like gone in a very weird way, which we'll talk about in a bit. So am I right in thinking the pair of them... both wanted to find Aegon first so that they could mold him into the... So they could take the first stab at molding him into the king that they want him to be. Is that what you took, Chris?
Yeah. Otto said, look, we need to kill Rhaenyra, Daemon, anyone on Team Black. Alison said, I think we should just send letters and try and get them to bend the knee. And so I suppose really, because we don't really know Aegon that well at this point, it's really about... which one of them can influence him, which one of them can shape him in their image, right? This is the next king. Is he going to be... like murderous, violent? Is he going to be peaceful? And so most of it was this sort of cat and mouse pursuit. Confusingly, each of Otto and Alison also has one of the identical twins, which made it so much more confusing for me. Why doesn't one of them have like a massive beard? Or why doesn't one of them have a silly hat to help us differentiate between them? Because they're called Eric
and Derek
and Arik.
Oh, Arik. I thought it was Derek. Right.
Arik and Eric. Could not one of them have a big sort of pair of glasses on? So that was the idea, I think, right? That like we've got to find him and sort of shape him. But actually, I mean, he is like a sort of late teens, right? Like he's probably already lost to the source in a way. He's sort of like...
Yeah, there was very much a whiff of, comparatively, maybe one of the princes in real world that may not be perfectly...
Or it's Prince Shakespearean Prince Hal, isn't it? Is that he's been out, you know, that's the old archetype, isn't it? It's a wastrel prince, then the seriousness of being king turns him around and all that sort of stuff. That's the Shakespearean idea, isn't it?
Yeah, and we did see that, didn't we? There was that kind of, you know, he was very much reluctant. He was quite happy just knobbing his way or getting it wet through Flea Bottom. Such a strangely naff name for a town in Westeros. You've got all these amazing names, and then all of a sudden Flea Bottom's there. But then there was the moment, there was a great ceremonial bit at his coronation, which again we'll talk about in a bit, he did get a taste for it. I got a sense that he kind of like, actually, this is pretty cool. If I just raise my sword, they cheer. I'll go again. Yeah. Hey. It was proper Robbie Williams singing Angels, wasn't it? At Glastonbury. It was like, hey. You know.
And this is a guy, though, that like, he doesn't think his dad ever loved him. He doesn't think his mum likes him. He doesn't think anyone, his brother doesn't seem to like him. So when you've got like tens of thousands of people cheering, you suddenly go, oh yeah, like maybe I am born for this. Maybe I can do this, like after all. But I think he is a bit lost because if you've already developed a taste for watching pointy teeth children tear chunks off each other, then I do think they've both sort of failed as guardians in that respect.
100%. Right, I tell you what, let's rewind, because we're skipping ahead a little bit.
Yes, we've got ahead of ourselves, haven't we?
Let's go back to the small council, because, you know, quite a number of things happened within that conversation.
Well, before even that, Jamie, what has compelled Alicent to do this, to lie? Is it because at the end of the last episode... Well, she is really, because the king was confused, wasn't he, at the end of the last episode.
But she has no idea about that conversation that he had with Rhaenyra. She's not been privy, because it's only been passed along from king to heir or queen to heir.
Yeah.
About Aegon the Conqueror's dream about the Night King and the winter that's coming and all of the rest of it and the prince that was promised. So as far as she thinks, and as far as anybody knows, she genuinely believes that to be true. And I was questioning the same thing, but there was a moment where she was talking to, and actually the way that Alicent was throughout this episode, she was really reluctant with this knowledge. I got the sense that she was genuinely felt compelled to carry out, I mean, obviously it suits her a lot better than Rhaenyra being queen.
Yeah.
But there was moments, you know, there was bits where she kind of regretfully kind of had to instigate it. There was the bit where she was talking to Otto. There was a bit again in the small council. I didn't really get a sense that she was bullshitting.
Is it because she feels she might be betraying the princess? You know, that I don't know. I couldn't quite tell really what her emotions were in it. And you also sort of think if he'd lived, because this also means the line of the heir being told about the Song of Fire and Ice has been broken, because she's not going to know what that is to relay to the new king, is she? She doesn't know what he was even talking about. So she's
true.
So does that mean that's been severed? And only
that's a good question.
And only the true heir really has had that knowledge imparted to them by their.
Chris, do you know? Is this a book thing, Chris? Do we know?
Not quite sure about that.
Okay. But
I think we established that, like, this thing about him foreseeing the Song of Ice and Fire has been put in the show. I think to just provide a bit of connective tissue.
Rhaenyra still knows.
She knows. She was told. Yeah. And they held the blade over the fire, and there was like High Valyrian written into it. I don't know if Alicent knows about that little trick about that dagger that if you get a hidden message in it.
The cat's paw dagger, yeah.
But she does, Alicent does sincerely believe she was told it's you, it's Aegon's dream. And she's like, okay, well, it doesn't matter how many Aegons there are, like, he must be referring to my son.
Yeah.
But I thought what was really clever was when her and Otto talk at the very start of the episode, she literally like thinks she's dropping like the biggest plot twist, where she's like, I have this crazy idea, it's Aegon. And Otto's like, yeah, we were going to do that anyway.
But that's what I meant about London Bridge has fallen. It felt very much like London Bridge has fallen. It's like, put into action. Yeah. The mile's been closed. The flags. You know, that was. I thought that was a really good Otto moment. His best moment by far.
Yeah.
Where, as I think, as all Hands of King and Chief of Staffs usually are in programs like this, all of a sudden they're prepared for any eventuality. It just so happens that this eventuality serves House Hightower very well indeed.
Yeah.
But I wasn't surprised to know that they kind of planned for Aegon to be king. What did surprise me was that there was also a separate side mission to kill Rhaenyra and Daemon. Mm. That to me was like, fucking hell. Okay, this is pretty major. And even to include your man Lannister in the plans, who seems like, I wouldn't trust him with anything. He does not strike me as the most secretive of people. But that small council meeting I thought was brilliant. A brilliant death.
Yeah.
There, just smashed, head smashed straight into the snooker ball, or the testicle, as Rhys Ifans calls it on set. It was like, why are we holding these testicles?
That's the thing. We've talked about how useless those snooker balls are. Yeah. It sort of finally came into its zone, because if it hadn't been there, Lord Beesbury might not have had his eyeball smashed in. You know, if it'd just been slightly to the left, or if they hadn't used them at all.
Yeah, it was great.
I love Bill Paterson so much, and the sound of his voice. That death cut deep for me. You know, if they're going to off anyone in the penultimate episode of a series of House of Dragon, not Bill Paterson. I just, you know, show some mercy. I know this is a bleak show that takes no prisoners, but just, you know, spare us.
He spoke sense. He was, he was the only one in that room speaking sense, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Regicide, treachery.
Yeah.
It was all coming out.
Yeah.
It was all coming out. And then we moved on to, I guess, the other major plot point was the, and this shows how well prepared Otto and the gang were,
is
because Rhaenys' bedroom was locked instantly, almost before almost before the small council was being held. Mm. Now, Chris, do you want to talk us through that a bit? Have you had to think about why that was? Was that because, am I right in thinking that they then also hid her dragon?
Yeah, well, they sort of like chained the dragon, but the dragon's in the dragon pit. That's where they sort of put them when they land.
Yeah.
And they locked her straight away. I mean, Otto said, look, close the doors. Like, we're not going to remove Lord Beesbury or whatever until we've sorted this. So everyone who was potentially loyal, even the handmaidens and the, you know, maids and stuff, were all put in the prisons. And obviously Rhaenys, who is related to Rhaenyra, they locked her in. What I thought was funny was when she opened the window to look at all the crowds, and I thought, you can get out of there. Like, first of all, because you've got like Rapunzel hair anyway, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I think just neutralizing the threats until they could go to her and sort of broker a deal. Obviously, it didn't work. Rhaenys is too smart for that. But yeah, just neutralizing threats until they've got the loyalists on board, until they sort of mentioned at one point, oh, there's two people in the City Watch that are still loyal to Daemon because Daemon used to be in charge of that. So they've sort of replaced them. They got all the lords. I think they were the lords of the Stormlands, which is the area immediately around King's Landing. They got them in that room. And that one guy was like, I'd like to phone a friend. And they were like, you can't do that. Sorry. You've got to just break your oath now.
He was sneaking out to tell, presumably to tell Rhaenyra, right?
I looked this up on IMDb because I was like, I never know who these random people are.
Lord Cardwell. Yeah.
Lord Cardwell. Yeah. There was Lady Fell as well.
Little sidebar, and actually, I guess something to look out for is who was Otto writing to when Alicent entered the room? That's what I want to know.
He said they were going to get in touch with the lords that weren't able to get there on the day.
Little
Riverlands and like the Vale and maybe even the Starks, maybe up the north? They'd be sort of sending them out to say,
I think we're going to see the Starks next week.
I think there's going to be, more families, like maybe next week or...
Surely this is, because we've got more Lannister involvement, surely this is the bit where we get the sort of expansion of the universe. I mean, what I loved about it was the rush to get him crowned as the tension at the heart of it. Because I was listening to a history podcast actually, and they were talking about when the Queen died and how basically, if you're a Republican in the UK, you've got about a nanosecond to make your case. And it's when Nicholas Mitchell says the Queen has died, the king will be moving on to, and that's it, game over. That's your time.
Yeah.
And so what you had here was this being, that, like you said, Jamie, that thing of this being played out in real time. Once the crown's on him and it's in front of a crowd, it's very hard to turn back on that. It's very hard to reverse that. It just gets that much more difficult. And so what I loved is the urgency of that, and obviously, of course, the best laid plans are being disrupted by the fact that Prince is a wastrel. I thought, just the machinations, and you can have everything worked out, but if the guy at the centre of it all, A, isn't interested, and B, is interested in whoring, you've got a problem, haven't you? They can't control
it.
Brilliant.
Yeah. One question. Last week, Rhaenyra and Daemon were just like, well, let's head back to Dragonstone. If you turned up and you were going to be the queen after your dad had carked it, and you saw your dad in that state, you'd be like, maybe we shouldn't like travel all the way back to Dragonstone because he didn't last the night.
Yeah.
Perhaps we should just wait.
Ridiculous. Yeah. The thing I couldn't believe was when Alicent like was shocked when they were like, yeah, he's dead. It's like, did you see him last night? Like, I would be crying if he was alive. What did you expect? He hasn't eaten for about 10 years.
Yeah. Stylistically, this was a really weird episode. I really enjoyed it, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I did give it a second watch and enjoyed it far more the second time, as I usually do, because the first time I'm just kind of like, who's that? Why are they doing this? What was that they said? Get the subtitles on, blah, 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 blah. But this one, stylistically, felt like a bit of a detective drama. Mm. It felt like a kind of medieval Cagney and Lacey, where you had like Kristen and Aemond kind of like just tootling off in their disguises, although Aemond's disguise is really shit. It's like, mate, you've got an eye patch on. There's not a lot you can do.
Sort of elf pirate, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Can we talk about kind of Kristen's hat that is supposed to disguise him?
But that's what I mean. Little like port pie hat, wasn't it? It was
hipster beanie that he had on. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right, so Kristen, though, he's getting more and more interesting. He's such a strange person. you know, his attitude to women and his attitude, and his obviously his attitude to violence. It's all very, 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 he's quite peculiar, isn't he? And it's going to get more peculiar.
Which way do you think he's going to go?
Well, I mean, he's a psychopath for a start, isn't he? Because what I love is all that knightly stuff. You know, it's all very courtly and he's knightly and he offers people his sword and all that sort of stuff. But he'll kill someone if he just has to. You know, bash someone's brains out if he doesn't like the prospect of them. So there's that sort
insulting
of...
insulting the queen.
Exactly. Yeah. That very sort of, you know, that in the end, all this honour and all this knightly stuff is bullshit. It's just, it's a complete... modus operandi for psychopaths. Literally, his armor is being a knight that's protecting him, the psychopath. You know, like it's very, very odd. And how he views, you know, what did he say about women? You know, he said something very strange about women and sex in this episode. We sort of think, wow, do you live in this universe where everyone's at it?
Yeah, he did, didn't he? And he also, he's very regretful of his.
Oh, yeah.
When he shot his shot for...
yes, he feels sullied, doesn't
he? Rhaenyra.
He's let himself down, he's let the guards down, he's let his regiment down.
Well, that's what he said. He said all women are in the image of the mother.
Yeah, that's it. There is one of the seven gods, you know, in the...
Yeah.
Okay. There was a weird little bit of sexual tension between Kristen and the Queen, wasn't there? Queen, is the Queen leading him on a little bit? She leant in and whispered something to him that felt a little bit breathy.
And, I think she's sort of blackmailing him a bit because she knows that he's not supposed to sleep around, and he did with Rhaenyra, and she kind of has used that to get him in her employment, basically. So I think he's probably keeping her sweet in a way, but also like she could have him killed. So he is a bit of a lapdog, isn't he? But he's quite batshit, like smashing heads in and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. He's bonkers, isn't he? No, I think she's one of the first people she practiced manipulating on. You know, after the wedding where he had no port, you know, who was he going to go to? Who was going to rescue him? And that's the sort of first person she started really manipulating. And so he's her sort of opening experiment in becoming, you know, tougher and stronger and part of the sort of Machiavellian arts that she needed to acquire. So he's sort of like, you know, she definitely uses her allure on him and definitely uses the fact that he doesn't think he should do anything about it. I mean, but he's surely going to explode into some sort of horrendous, you know, further psychopathic violence at some point.
I'm still not convinced he's going to make it past the end of the season.
Right, okay.
I don't know. There's just something there where... I mean, maybe he will. Maybe he'll end up being like the Brienne of Tarth and we'll become deeply honourable and have some kind of mea culpa moment and all the rest of it. But at the moment, he still feels a little bit on the periphery as a character, I think, somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
For me. But we got introduced also to the White Worm in this episode. We've seen the White Worm before, though, right? Unless I'm going absolutely crazy.
Yeah, that's the girl Damon pretended.
Damon's old. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's. I thought so. Now, Missaria is a name, and she is now, whether she was doing this before or not, I'm not entirely sure, but she's now like head of the people's KGB in Westeros and has set up this kind of like network of whisperers or little birds, as Varys would have called them back in the day, but is on like seemingly on some kind of moral crusade to stop the pits of fighting children in exchange for information. What do we make of her? And am I right in thinking that was her house that was being burnt down at the end?
I think so.
Yeah, I think it was I didn't catch that on the first watch. On the second one, I was like, oh, I think that's the brothel. I found it quite hard to understand what was going on there because, you know, what Game of Thrones would do is sort of build this up, but it was just like, here she is, she's got her own sort of like whisper network and like, you know, and she's sort of working with Otto a little bit and Laris Strong knows who she is. It's kind of difficult to really, I can't really speak to it that much, but what I would say is like...
Well, she's the threat, isn't she? She says to Otto, you've only got the power that the people let you have. You know, there's a revolutionary flavour to what she was saying or something. Mm. So maybe that's why...
She's like the Mick Lynch.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah. All the prostitutes out, everyone out. Maybe that's why her house is destroyed. It's the hand pushing back at her and saying, "I know where you live. You know you can't come at me like can't come at me like that. Although obviously all of his
right. So it wasn't. So they weren't burning. They weren't burning that fight. The kid fighting pit down. Then that was her. That was her brothel. We think it wasn't Otto doing what.
Right, I think okay. so. But I thought that was a very interesting moment. Her saying you're only as powerful because after all the thing in the Game of Thrones books. Is it's very much about how the machinations of these people at the top affect the lives of ordinary people and how bad things can get when the people are playing the Game of Thrones. You know what I mean? So to have someone speak for the people and go, do you mind? You know, your power only is dependent on us. I thought was really it's a surprising texture because you didn't very often yeah. hear that in Game of Thrones itself, that there's, you know, except maybe in the form of the High Sparrow, who was leveraging a different kind of power. But, but her to say the people city,
very rarely had a say, did they?
Exactly, yeah. exactly.
The only time we saw the really kind of clap back was in the Shame walk yes. with Cersei, wasn't it? Yeah, that's right.
I think what was really good at having Missaria sort of have that moment is so that by the end of the episode, when we see the very good PR strategy of getting all the common folk to witness it, that's kind of where it links to, right? Where she's like, we decide if you've got power and where you get power. And I suppose it sort of sets up that idea that like, yeah, they crowned Aegon in full view of the public to sort of cement him as like the people's king.
Yeah. I love the name The White Worm as well. It's a really good, real good seedy kind of spy name as well.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
And also that scene, the scene between her and Otto had my favourite line, I think, of the whole episode, which was a further peel in this stinking onion.
Yes.
What a great line. What a fucking great line that was. Well done.
Yeah.
And then we see Rhaenys escape. Was that Derek or Eric that let him out? I get confused. It was one of them, wasn't it?
There could be a third one called Beric. We don't know, do we? This is the thing.
It was Eric. Producer Connor is the only one taking them seriously.
But now there's one on the blacks and one on the greens, which helps.
Right, fine. So, I mean, this is our mountain, the hound in the mountain again, all over again, isn't it? And so Rhaenys escaped. She wanted to go and get her dragon. Remind me of the dragon's name. It's quite a straight name, isn't it?
Melisse?
Yeah, that was it. Melisse. She wanted to go and get the dragon. And Eric was just like, no, you've got to get down to, there's a boat waiting for you on Blackwater. She had other ideas and was quite happy when they got split up.
Yeah.
And gave that little knowing smile when the crowd was led her towards the dragon pit. Now, who the hell, I don't know who does town planning in King's Landing, but I would not in a million years put some kind of like ceremonial hall directly above a fucking dragon pit. That to me seems like lunacy. That's like
I wrote in my notes that it's the equivalent would be like William and Kate getting married at Battersea Dogs Home. Like there's just no reason.
Yeah, but exactly. Nuclear.
There's no reason things. For it.
Nuclear Battersea Dogs Home.
Sellafield. Yeah.
Sellafield, yeah.
Coronation on top of Sellafield. Yeah, just a bit stupid. Why run the risk? Why, if there's a million and one chance, just don't do it. You know, it could.
Yeah.
So she's like,
Who could have seen this happen? Yeah.
I also enjoyed the vastness of that room, which was brilliant. Probably had what, 20,000-30,000 people in it, and yet Rhaenys was just able just to very, very quickly just sneak to the edge and go down a flight of stairs and to the dragon. That bit was great.
Well, she knows a way round, you know.
She does know, yeah.
I mean, sometimes you can't get hung up on that kind of thing, can you? Because that moment when she burst through the floor with a dragon, I shouted, oh my God, to the point my wife came downstairs and said, what, are you all right? What's happened? So, and you think I've been watching Game of Thrones stuff and House of the Dragon for a long time. So to get it to do that, just shows. I just thought that was such a fantastic moment. And what
it was really
and what does it mean? Right. You know, I mean, it's such an interesting moment because they are usurpers. They have gone against, and she said, we're a family of our word, didn't she? So what's going to happen to us?
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, civil war, surely.
But the word of my house is not,
that's it.
The word of my house is not fickle.
That's it. Yeah. That's what she said. Yeah.
So this was kind of like forespoken, and we knew that something was coming because actually it was quite heavily, you know, for Game of Thrones, it was pretty heavily kind of like thrust upon it. It was like, by the way, the beast, Don't forget the beast beneath the boards. I said, this is important. Don't forget the, you know, there was, it was quite a few times, more than is usual for Game of Thrones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know whether it was to try and just because there's going to be a lot of people that haven't seen Game of Thrones, but normally that kind of foreshadowing, you have to go back and find it, you know, after the event.
Yeah, yeah.
So we all kind of knew that something was up. We discussed last week about Helena is, for me now, one of the most interesting of the Targaryens. Because she is the, she seems to be the one that's been graced with magic, or the, the kind of third eye, the three-eyed raven sense of whatnot. And I was keeping a real close eye on her this time, and she couldn't look at Aegon barely at all. She barely looked at him in the eye and kept looking over at Aemond. So I don't know whether there was I mean, there's not a shot wasted in Westeros, as we know. So that clearly meant something.
Yeah.
Now, I think the Dreamers section is really, really interesting and really, really important. And we did a bit of digging around because I think people will find it interesting too. So some Targaryens are born with the ability to see into the future, and they've got visions of events that haven't yet come to pass. And that's what we've seen with Helena. Now, these Targaryens with that ability to prophesize the future are referred to as dreamers. Daenerys the Dreamer had the gift of prophecy. She and her family survived the Doom of Valyria because they sold all of their holdings and belongings 12 years before the Doom, and they left Valyria, moving instead onto Dragonstone. That's how the Targaryen kind of lineage survived. We learned that Aegon the Conqueror was a dreamer when Viserys revealed to Rhaenyra back in, I think it was probably 8-1, the threat from the north in the Song of Ice and Fire. Now, Viserys has also had a vision himself. He had a vision that Emma would give birth to a male heir. The vision came true, but of course, his son died shortly after birth. Daenerys Targaryen saw the Iron Throne in a vision with snow falling over the halls. This vision came true much, much later in the series when she finally arrived in King's Landing and took the throne for herself, albeit a bit briefly. But for me, it's still one of the most important parts of that universe. And we've spoken about this, Chris, is the magic. And that for me was something that had been missing. And I was really pleased that there seems to be elements of that in there. She's going to be quite a powerful ally because she doesn't seem to be, I can't work out whose side she is on. As much as Bran, I guess, in Thrones wasn't really on anyone's side. He was just like, he was a bit like the fella out of Love Island that was just like, that's just the way it is. Tis what it is. You know, it's a bit like that, isn't he? It's just kind of like, nothing I can do about it, mate. It's been foreseen, hasn't it? You know? And she's probably a bit like that, isn't she? Did you get the sense that she was maybe anti-Alicent?
I think Chris? You mean Helena? I think she, I mean, if I was constantly telling people that something tragic was about to happen and they ignored me, I would just get so fucked off. And I'm surprised she doesn't have like an Alan Partridge dictaphone around to her to just jot these down, because she told that nanny.
All she had to say was, rather than the beast, beware the beast beneath the boards, go, Rhaenyra's going to fuck you all up at Aegon's coronation. Yeah. That's all she had to say.
What they probably, because she sort of told the nanny in this episode, she was like, there is a beast beneath the boards. And she was like, yeah, cool. Kind of busy here.
No idea what that
kind
means.
Of busy, kind of busy raising your children, actually, and I don't get paid. But I think, whenever she says something now, it's important to listen. She actually said something really interesting this episode, which is not as cryptic, but she said, it is our fate to crave what is given to another. If one possesses a thing, the other will take it away, which is kind of what this whole conflict is based on, isn't it?
Yeah.
She was also doing an embroidery of a giant spider, and there was a lot of talk in this episode about spiders, threads, webs.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Chris, you are my, well, basically you spend the time watching the opening titles, so I don't have to.
Yes.
And you notice quite a few things. And a spider cropped up in that as well, didn't it? Take us through it.
Yes. I'm sure you mentioned that. Sorry. I'm just making it up as I go along. No, basically, we've talked about this intro before, and because all the characters have the same sigil, because they're all Targaryens, the icons change, they're sort of a bit more tailored to their characters. And we saw when branches of the family sort of develop in the show, we see rivers of blood sort of pooling off from people, and we saw the sort of sigils or the trademark badges of each of Alicent and Viserys' children. And Helena's is a spider, because she kind of loves bugs. She's into like creepy crawlies. She was playing with a millipede in one episode. So I think it's sort of interesting as a sort of nod to that. But also Aemond's icon is a sapphire, and that is a reference to the fact that in the books, when he loses his eye, he just jams a sapphire in there to sort of style it out.
Does he? Oh, yeah. Wow, that's pretty cool.
And, so like, maybe
like
we'll...
Mick Hucknall did that with a ruby in his tooth.
Yeah. It's basically that. Yeah, the glass eye industry has not taken off in Westeros quite yet. And then Aegon's is like a naked woman with a crown, which maybe someone who has read the books can sort of point us to that. The other thing to mention about that, though, is that there are four... Alicent and Viserys have actually had four children. One of them has just not been featured in the show. And that is because there is already, like, 50 feral children running around. So I think Daeryon or Daeron is going to be
Daeryon
too. But Daeryon...
It's just Daeryon, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can it not be just Daeryon?
Yeah. Daeryon.
Eric, Derek, and Darren.
No, it's interesting. And if anyone has seen anything in the intro that they think is interesting, they should let us know. Because if I didn't watch it twice, I wouldn't have picked up on stuff like this. But
yeah. No, so George R. R. Martin in his kind of like put his head above the parapet after King Viserys' death last week and said how pleased he was with Paddy's performance, and then mentioned that Daeryon.
That's right.
Is in season two. He's just been in Old Town. He was just
on a gap year,
like you say, Chris.
Basically,
he was on a gap year. Just is it a kibbutz in Old Town?
Yeah.
Just because I think it mainly because there was too many kids, like you say. And we saw even more. A little side note: when we watched the trailer for this episode last week, we thought that one of Aegon's bastard children were in prison, but they weren't. They were just slumped in the corner of the the sharp toothed child pit.
Absolutely deranged.
But there are more of them lurking around, which is going to be a huge problem, especially if they're the firstborn heir.
Yeah.
You know,
absolutely.
Okay, so let's get on to the coronation. And actually, part of what we saw at the coronation was the fact that Aegon, as part of Alicent's way of trying to unify and legitimize Aegon's coronation, you know, she linked it as tightly as she could to his namesake, Aegon the Conqueror, the original person who had the dream, who foresaw the prince that was promised. And in doing so, gave her son Aegon the Conqueror's crown, which was an actually really cool kind of Kylo Ren style kind of crown with a little, and that had a little ruby in the middle of it. I don't know if you noticed that as well. And also the sword that he was given was quite prominent as well. And that sword was called Blackfyre. And we thought, you know, as we like to delve into a few things, it's time for a bit of Blackfyre wisdom. So here we go. Now, Blackfyre is the fabled bastard sword of Valyrian steel once wielded by Aegon the Conqueror. A bastard sword's a hand-and-a-half sword that enables blows to be delivered with the power of a two-handed sword, but can also be wielded with one hand. Blackfyre is the most famous of all the Valyrian steel swords ever owned by House Targaryen. Another famous Valyrian blade owned by the family is Dark Sister. That's wielded by Daemon Targaryen, which he used to eviscerate the Crab Feeder and more recently take the head of Vaemond Velaryon, although he did let him keep his tongue, obviously. Now, both during and in the aftermath of Aegon's conquest, King Aegon I Targaryen carried Blackfyre and used it in combat, for executions, and in the conflicts in Dorne. Aegon loved Blackfyre so much that when he died, Blackfyre was created with him on his funeral pyre. Maegor the Cruel retrieved the blade from the ashes, and it had been made darker by the fire, but was otherwise undamaged. Aegon was succeeded by Aenys I, but being an adequate swordsman at best, Aenys bestowed the blade to his younger, more suited to combat brother Maegor. After Aenys died in 42 AC, Maegor flew to Dragonstone to claim the crown. And when Maester Gwen insisted that the Iron Throne should pass to Aenys' son Prince Aegon, Maegor beheaded Gwen with Blackfyre. Now when the realm began to unite against Maegor, Queen Rhaena Targaryen stole the sword from him and gave it to Aenys' son Prince Jaehaerys, who'd announced his own claim at Storm's End. Maegor was eventually found dead on the Iron Throne, and legend grew that it was the throne itself that had claimed him. Jaehaerys used the sword to slay the rebel Boris Baratheon during the Third Dornish War. Jaehaerys also killed Sir Braxton Beesbury in trial by combat after Braxton was found to have seduced the king's daughter, Princess Syra. Blackfyre passed through Jaehaerys to Viserys I, who carried it through his long and mostly peaceful reign. Now that Viserys has died, Blackfyre, along with the crown of Aegon the Conqueror, has been claimed by Aegon II, who hoisted Blackfyre above his head in celebration at his coronation. The Greens will no doubt hope these ancient symbols of Targaryen greatness will enhance the legitimacy of Aegon's claim against his rival, Viserys' long-named heir, Princess Rhaenyra Targaryen. Or should that be Queen Rhaenyra Targaryen? While you digest all of that Blackfyre wisdom, just a little word from our sponsors. See you in a second.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Goodness me. I tell you what, the denseness of the family tree and the royal chain of command in George's world is pretty intense. You're a history buff, Al. Yeah. How does that stack? How does it stack up in like War of the Roses-esque kind of real life?
Oh, this is all, that's what's so brilliant about this, is it's all entirely plausible, because this is the stuff of certainly all this kings and people personally offing each other. It's very much post the end of the Viking era into the early Middle Ages. Although I don't know if we use that term anymore in history, although those have all been changed. But yeah, I mean, this is very much like Viking kings or Norse kings or early French kings, early English kings. It's got that real flavour of the entanglement. And, you know, the idea that every now and again there's a central king who is in charge of everything, but then his underlings, if he's weak, his underlings take over. And I think what obviously George R.R. Martin really loves is the thing of having someone young and ill-prepared coming to the throne, you know, in the manner of Henry VI or, God, I mean, Edward VI, who tends to be the guys with a six in their number. But, you know, where basically then what happens is there's someone who's supposed to be a benign uncle who's in charge, and then he's got other angry uncles, and then there's other people who think, well, actually, this claim is illegitimate, and all that sort of tension. And that is such a brilliant plot device to add to a world where this is how people settle their disputes in a kind of no man, yeah, no argument way. And I think, you know, it all sounds, you know, if you didn't know that was from a fantasy universe, you'd think it was the real thing. You know, Harold Hardrada and whatever, right, and all those sort of people.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
Chris, we've known each other a while now, Chris, haven't we?
Yeah.
And there's something you've been after for a while. So I think before we get on to Maylies, I think, there you go, mate. Just crack on.
Oh, thank crack you on so much.
Just whenever you want to go, just go. I'll avert my eyes. If you want to knock one out, just go for it. Let's talk about, I think there's no other way of naming it. There's no other
we
way of naming
it
other than it. Other than Footwank Gate. I mean, I
I don't know. The way it was trailed, because there was this lingering close-up of his feet as he arrived, wasn't there?
Yeah.
So you're thinking, okay, right, well, what? What's that for? An awkward edit? You know, what's going on?
Yeah.
And the next thing you know,
never a shot wasted. Never a shot wasted. And so, I mean, aside from the actual kind of, I loved it. It was like a brilliant Game of Thrones kind of like, yeah, you want to see sick? This is pretty out there. I mean, I don't know if it was in the books. I'm not entirely sure from the reaction I've read online this morning. I don't think it was necessarily in the books. So for someone, I think, you know, for Ryan Condal and whoever the script writers were to sit down and go, we need something kind of like, just to kind of demonstrate the kind of hold that Larys has over Alicent and the weird kind of relationship that they've got, because they needed to answer a question, which is why would Larys want to help? What does he want out of the relationship?
Yeah,
he hinted to her on the boat, I think, in a couple of episodes back, was, well, when the time comes, I'm sure you'll be appreciative or something. He said something like that. Mm. We all thought it was going to be like, I don't know, a pot of gold or like a nice seat at the small council or something like that. No, he just wanted to shoot his wad over her toes. now, for the script writers to go, right, we need something that's going to be kind of classic Thronesy, that's going to be a bit Tyrion, bit kind of like
bit kinky.
A bit reek, a bit kinky. They just went straight to Tarantino, didn't they? They were just like, perfect. What would Quentin Tarantino write in? Oh, he'd absolutely have someone wanking over Alicent's feet. I thought it was actually really good.
Yeah.
Aside from the kind of like, you know, clearly kind of like people are gone, oh my God, that's disgusting. It's like, babes, never check my hard drive. That was nothing. So
the thing is, it's a really good, because it's a really specific character detail, right? Like you could write it that he wants to sleep with Alicent, and you're like, yeah, okay, you could read it that way. But he's got like a sort of a club foot, and he's obsessed with
the layers
feet.
Of it are brilliant.
And also, like, also, I everyone's into their own thing, but I just respect someone who is able to masturbate under 7 layers of cloaks. Because that was, that looked so complicated.
I mean, why be shy at that point?
Just get it out. Yeah, you know, we're all friends here.
Yeah, I mean, you've gone that far.
But I thought it was a really good detail.
Well, also, I mean, so he does murders for her if she needs him doing. And in return, that's what he wants in return? I mean, is this the deal? That he gets to do his sexy foot wank?
I mean it's, you know, it's a proper power play, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and there's the hand of the king and the feet of the queen, you know, and it's
the feet of the king. The feet of the king. What I thought is really interesting, though, is that, like, I thought, oh, he's just like, he'll do anything for her because he's really into her. But also, you kind of asked Jamie, like, why is he sort of fighting for her so strongly? Like, bear in mind, the rumor is that Rhaenyra burnt most of his family alive, right? Obviously, he seems to have been behind that. But, like, he kind of needs to look like he blames Rhaenyra for that, right? Like, that's the sort of, that was the rumor going around, was that her team were behind it. So I think in some ways he needs to look like a devout fan of the Greens to sort of throw people off the trail, as it were. But something I thought about this, just when I watched it the second time, the first time I just thought that is a really specific detail. It's so, like, it speaks so much about him. I actually think there's something really clever with this, because I think Alicent thinks she's got him wrapped around her finger or toe or anything like that. She thinks she's got him where she wants him because he's obsessed with her. But I think because of that, he's actually sort of playing her a little bit, where he's sort of like, the idea is, like, she thinks I'm obsessed with her, so she will look the other way when I sort of work against her. Like, I just don't trust him. And I think there's so much to it that it's not as simple as, like, oh my God, he just, like, gets off on
it. I mean, but we know that he's going to double cross Alicent, because he's already offered himself to Otto. To Otto and said, you know, Otto was kind of like, you've been spending a bit of time with my daughter, you fucking weirdo. And he's like, yeah, but that, why don't you tell me how you want me to mold her, and I can, and I can steer her that way.
Yeah.
Is he the spider? Is he the spider?
Did you also notice, I mean, this might already have been established, but he was referred to as the Lord Confessor for the first time, which is the official torturer. And I kind of wondered if the thing where he was cutting people's tongues out and getting them out of the prisons, if he's been given this official role where he's, he's the sort of CIA torturer, the Kiefer Sutherland, Jack Bauer of Westeros.
I'm going to say, hey, I won't have that. Jack Bauer would never have broken protocol like that. He got addicted to heroin for 3 episodes, but he would never have cut people's tongues out.
I think if it had got him to find out where the bomb was, he'd have gone, get me a pair of scissors now.
Well, but would he have had a cheeky foot wank if that he got found out what our guide were up to?
Jack Bauer wouldn't have done, but Kiefer Sutherland too.
Jack Bauer has to maintain his cover as an employee at the Birkenstocks shop.
Yeah, exactly.
And we'll do anything to keep it.
Moving on to, I guess, the kind of ultimate, the cliffhanger, the big moment that we talked about, which was Maelys the dragon, the beast beneath the boards did turn out to be a dragon beneath the ceremony. I think this has been quite divisive online. People were kind of like, oh, that was a bit kind of like, I wasn't really all that turned on by that. I quite enjoyed it. It felt very much, again, mirroring the dragon saving Daenerys from the dragon pit. Was it a dragon pit in Dawn or somewhere at one point?
Where
Sons of Harpy were about to kill them at one point. And that was the first time that we saw Daenerys on a dragon, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And flew away with that. It felt very much like that. There were people putting up the memes of Shrek eating Lord, with the dragon eating Lord Farquaad. What did you make of it, Chris? What was your feeling about it tonally?
Yeah.
And because I actually think it needed to be there to set up what's going to come in episode 10. But I'm interested to know what you thought.
Well, the first time I watched it, I thought I was like, ow, I like literally gasped when she like burst through the ground. Like, I couldn't believe it. I thought it was really great. I really wanted to see Rhaenys like step up and do something really cool. So that was amazing. When I watched it the second time, I thought, yeah, it does feel like it's sort of, they kind of went with the visuals first. Like, wouldn't this look cool? And then have tried to like justify it afterwards. There's a inside the episode video on HBO's YouTube where they sort of try and explain it a little bit. I mean, I think the explanation is a little thin, but it's a really cool moment, because what I sort of thought on the second watch was that whole coronation was about imagery. It was about PR. It was Aegon the Conqueror's crown, the original sword, you know, all the Targaryen imagery. And then Rhaenys kind of goes, you want to see some Targaryen imagery? I'm on the back of a massive fucking dragon and I've just killed a few random people and I'm off. And that for me was like, if you want to see what power and command and like bloodlust looks like, this is it. And I didn't even, I could have killed you all. I didn't. And off I go. So I think in a sort of like symbolic thing, I thought it was fucking amazing. But I just, again, I'm like holding an important event like that on top of the dragon pit. Just crazy. So I don't know, like mixed really.
I'm with you on that. I think it was good to see Eve Best, and you know, clearly now we've been for a lot of this season going, why aren't they using Eve Best more? Because she's fucking great.
Yeah.
And you know, it looks like Rhaenys is now like heading into one hell of a season two. What do you think? She's now clearly, she's gone off to warn Rhaenyra, right? Al, that's where she's gone. She's like flown off. She's like, quick, it's all fucking gone to shit. What did you make of it all?
Well, as a sort of way of shifting the gear, what's been really impressive with this season is even this first series is, even though it's like had lots of really massive moments, a big shocking moments and big sort of twists and the time shifts and everything, which have taken some getting used to, they've still held off what this actually all comes down to, which is that someone's on the throne who shouldn't be. They've actually taken 9 episodes over that, and you could have started where we are this week, but they decided not to. So as a sort of, statement of intent for what's to come, I mean, what's so fantastic about this series is the dragons have been in it right from the beginning. We haven't got to wait for the bloody things. What we've got to wait for is the igniting moment, which is you put the crown on on Aegon, and that's when everything changes. Because it's almost like, I mean, it's symbolism in that, you know, if you build things on a lie, they're going to explode. It had that symbolism in it too, that the lie cannot stand, and that these are the forces that they're actually toying with. Not like, have you got the White Worm under control? Have you got him out of the, have you got Aegon out the brothels? Have you got your ducks in a row politically? There's at much bigger forces at work. And I mean, the fact that she kills a load of innocent people though, to sort of make this point, or lay down this gauntlet, is very Game of Thrones.
I'm presuming she did.
Well,
I mean, she just burst through there were like 30,000 people stood there. There's no way that they all survived.
Yeah, so even though she's done that, she's not exactly be popular with the people of King's Landing, is she? So as a way of securing people to her cause, that maybe wasn't so brilliant either, you know. But I don't know, I loved it. I loved it because it's the sort of, this episode is when finally the thing that's obviously going to cause a great big civil war that's going to last however many years on our tellies, it's where we've got to. And you needed a big moment like that to go, dunno, it's happening now.
Yeah, no, I agree. Before we wrap up, let's just talk about Alicent. It was most definitely her episode, in as much as Viserys's was episode 8. And I think fair to say that Rhaenyra is going to get her moment next week.
Yeah.
I thought Olivia Cooke was just fucking excellent. She is, no one can eye roll like Alicent Hightower. there was a bit where Otto said to her, oh, you don't half look like, when he tries to rein her in a bit, you don't half look like your mother in a certain light. And she just rolled her eyes as if to say, oh, fuck off, man.
Yeah.
Give us a break.
Yeah.
Her face acting is just wonderful. The moment where she, at the end where she stood in front, where she kind of like, not that it would have made a blind bit of difference, she would have still been burnt to ash, trying to protect Aegon and pushing Helena, getting Kristen to go and just get Helena, forgetting she didn't even mention Aemond at all. She was just like, told Kristen Cole to go and save Helena, and she stood in front of Aegon. Just astounding acting again from Olivia. And I think they've planned it quite well, certainly in terms of award season. Viserys had his episode, Alicent's getting this one, and Rhaenyra's getting the next one. Just really kind of like, look at our three leads that we've had in this season. All of them absolutely fucking brilliant. And I don't know where Alicent's going to go. I thought she was going to be evil and nasty, and that's the way it was going. But there's a glimmer of hope there, I think, in this one. Maybe. What do you think, Al?
Well, she obviously felt that the King's call for resolution in his family last week was actually something worthwhile and something valid, and that they ought to reconcile, and they're better off if they do, and that all the machinations and everything are dishonest to the King's will. I thought that was what's really interesting about that dinner, even though the kids didn't think so, and the kids saw it as an opportunity to try and hang shit on each other. I thought that was really interesting, and she'd obviously taken that to heart, which is why she doesn't want Daemon offed and all that sort of stuff. You can see that, and it's always this, you know, this thing in Westeros that everyone's conflicted, everyone's nuanced, everyone's complicated by the situation they're in, you know. And I think that you're right. I think she's got the kids got a good height. What can I tell you? You know what I mean? And I think that's really showing it. Or she's trying to honour the king in what she's doing, which I think is really interesting, because Otto Hightower has no interest in honouring the king at all. Could be arsed with it.
Not at all. Chris, what did you make of Olivia's performance this week?
I thought she was amazing. I mean, I think this episode particularly, she's doing so much. Like, because there's a scene where she sees Viserys' body as it's getting wrapped up. And I just, you know, she's kind of mourning him. Because I do think, like, she cared for him deeply.
Yeah.
And I think she's mourning him, but also she knows that she's heard this sort of whisper of a, you know, it's you have to get Aegon on the throne, or whatever she thought she heard. In order to do that, she might have to facilitate a lot of violence. And I think a lot of the crying and a lot of the breakdown is like, I don't know how to do this. Like, I'm not prepared. I'm not a Targaryen. I don't understand any of this. And so I thought this episode was so good. She's really trying to like save her son in a way from falling into this sort of destructive cycle. And I just found all of it really empowering, really powerful. Particularly what Rhaenys says to her, which is, you know, you are always going to be in service to these men. Like, you're never going to be free. You're just making a window in the wall of your prison. Like, and everything that she does, whether it's Kristen, whether it's Larys, whether it's her father, her sons, she is sort of in service to them in some way. And I think it's so interesting that she is trapped, literally.
Yeah.
I thought it was just, it's so complex. And you know, it has been a slow burning show, but like, it's got to this point that we've seen all of these moments where she's been forced into this system. And now, even though her husband's died, she's not got any more control. She's not got any more power. She thought Aegon being on the throne was her idea. And literally all the men in the room were like, we're 5 steps ahead of you. Already planned it, babe. You know, it's like fucking hard. So I'm really, I can't really get a steer on where it's going to go, but obviously Rhaenys is going to head over to Rhaenyra, and it's going to blow up. It's this powder keg moment, isn't it, really?
Well, I'll tell you what, let's not be around the bush. Shall we all watch the trailer for next week's
episode this season?
I know. Oh. Right, let's all go and watch it and see in a sec.
Okay.
The Greens are coming for you, Rhaenyra, and for your children.
You cannot bend the knee to the High Towers. They stole your birthright.
Every man standing around the painted table urges her to plunge the realm into war.
Lay siege to the Red Keep.
Send us.
I swear to ward the Queen.
Your cause owns a power that has not been seen since the days of old Valyria.
Oh my God. Amazing.
Yeah.
I actually have seen it already, but I saw it again and...
Wow. Okay. So, things to unpick... Is that a glimpse of Corlys Velaryon at the beginning, maybe?
It's weird. Like, if he was going to die, he'd have died, right?
Yeah.
And I think he's okay.
Yeah, I think almost certainly he's going to come back.
Let me see.
Almost
unless certainly. I see the body, he's alive.
Yeah. Show me the body. Yeah, exactly. And there was someone looking, just kind of staring at the out to sea. And I got a feeling that was Corlys Velaryon, but I could well be wrong. So let's see what we've got there. So we've got Rhaenys obviously got back there, informs them. They look kind of slightly surprised and shocked by the whole thing. Amazing kind of like war table in Dragonstones with the fire, with the like the fire underneath it, kind of backlit. It's like a gamer's table version of like, it's like a streamer's like thing, isn't it? It's like, that's exactly what my sons would have. They'd have LED strips underneath it. They're like, can we get like a, and Phil Daniels and all the gang there advising it. Again, a room full of men advising a woman. It's going to pretty much mirror Alicent's, I think, but Jesus fucking Christ, there's a lot of dragons.
But that crown, this is your, who was that crown being offered to? They didn't show us.
Well, I think that's, is that Derek or Eric?
That's the one Rhaenys stole, which was Viserys's crown. Yeah. So I presume they're giving that.
Oh, hang on a second. I didn't know she'd stolen the crown. I missed that bit.
Yeah.
Did that happen? Did I see that?
Well, I presume. I mean, it's there, right? So, like...
Yeah. Yeah, but you know what I mean? We're not shown who it's being offered to. I mean, I think it's obvious.
Yeah, that's true.
It ought to be obvious, but they do not show us.
Producer Connor is saying that Eric took it. Did we see that, Producer Connor?
When did Eric? I don't remember.
Maybe I missed it. Sorry,
sure it was Eric. Not,
I presume it was in the giant weekend bag that Rhaenys fitted her armor in. Because where did that come from? Got one of those Mary Poppins bags. Oh, yeah. Just a three-piece set of armor.
So it looks like, I don't know, where the kids were saying, send us, they all jumped in their dragons. Yeah. I'm not sure they were going to war, though.
No.
I
think Al said earlier in this episode that, like, I think we're going to see a bit more of Westeros. Yeah. And I wonder if everyone is going out to try and get, the Arryns, the Starks, the Greyjoys. Like, I wonder if we're going to see all these, you know, kids sort of going out and like, we saw one, I think, is it Jace sort of running towards his dragon, who looks that little dragon, fucking hell. So after seeing some of these big fellas, this one looks really pathetic, doesn't it? It's like a tiny little greyhound puppy.
But then, interestingly, you know, Daemon singing that lovely kind of like kind of Royksopp number. That's his dragon, right? It felt like he was a little bit tentative
about approaching it. I think his is red, isn't it? I think.
Yeah, yeah. So whose is that then? Maybe he's going to...
Maybe they're trying to win, because he already was hatching some eggs. Well, maybe they're trying
to... Maybe it's Rhaenys' dragon or something, you know, like... Because maybe they are...
Oh.
Producer Connor is saying he thinks it's a wild dragon.
Producer Connor knows what's up. He's got his own spider's web, I think.
Right.
Yeah, I think he's the white worm. So there wasn't that much else to put away other than it looks like both women have had a choice. Yeah. You know, Alison has had a choice, and now it looks like it's Rhaenyra's turn. It's kind of like you can either go about this a diplomatic way and try and find a diplomatic route, or you can rain merry hellfire on the whole
what's
King's
the
Landing.
What on earth is the diplomatic solution in this when someone takes your throne?
Well, I don't know, but I think, you know, but Alison was trying to find that, wasn't she? She was like, maybe can we just send a letter and ask nicely? And maybe that...
Yeah. Have you considered stepping down?
Ask the 1922 committee to sort it out for you.
Because there's got to be a point where there has to be a point, unless this turns into some kind of farcical plot point where Rhaenyra never mentions to Alicent about Aegon's dream. You know, there has to be that conversation where they go,
no,
he told me about
at some point, right? And go, why do you think, it's like the finals of The Apprentice, why do you think you should be running the country? Well, I heard a dream and it explicitly mentioned Aegon. Right, well, I've got an Aegon who says that it's about him. We need them to get in.
Hang on a sec, Chris. This is not going to be like Team Will and Team Gareth in Pop Idol, mate. There's not a red and blue bus being driven around the UK.
Everyone gets five phone votes, okay? You may be charged. Please ask for bill payer's permission. One thing I would like to mention that I actually went back and sort of froze the YouTube clip is Otto meeting with Daemon at Dragonstone.
On the bridge.
On the bridge, which is a callback. They did that in I think it was episode 2. They had a conflict there.
Yeah.
So there's obviously something, maybe delivering some terms, but surely Otto's not going to survive that. I mean, we've seen what Daemon can do with a sword.
What would possibly protect Otto in that circumstance?
Maybe Aemond. Aemond is maybe with him, who is like Daemon's like sort of, brother from another Nemesis. Cousin or whatever. You know, they're kind of similar, aren't they? I think if he's gone there, he'll have brought some backup. But yeah, it just feels like, I think normally we talk at the start of the episode about like episode 9 is usually really intense, episode 10 is usually a bit quiet, but this feels like it's going to be absolutely massive.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it looks like it's just setting up for war, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Al, you're going to love this segue. Speaking of war, you've been a busy boy, haven't you, lately?
Yes.
You've been, you're now an author.
Yes.
You're now like a proper, talk us through Command, your book, which is out right now.
Out right now. And it's called Command, How the Allies Learned to Win the Second World War. And because I do a history podcast about the Second World War called We Have Ways of Making You Talk with James right. Holland, who's a proper historian. And then there's me going, go on, tell me what happened to Alamein, like that. And and it's all incredibly interesting. And it's sort of burgeoned into this thing. And we did a festival last year, a festival this year with historians and tanks and stuff. And it's been an amazing project to be involved in. Anyway, that led to this book. And the idea of the book is it's the progress of the Second World War. I take 10 people to tell the story of how the British and Americans go from being essentially clueless at the start of the war to by the end of it having this sort of incredible grinding war machine that destroys everything that's put in front of it. And so I've got famous people in it. So there's Monty and Patton in it. And then I've got people no one's ever heard of, like Alistair Pearson and Peter White, who are lower down the food chain, and a couple of generals no one would have heard of as well. And it's about like how you go from being really not knowing what to do at all, and how the Germans and the Japanese get the jump on the British. And then by the end of the war, that it's all really, really like nailed down. But also what that means for people, and what if you're an infantry platoon commander in 1945, what that actually means, what you have to do, what it's like, and the fact that you live in all the time, you're living on the edge of death the entire time. You could be killed any second. The guy next to you could die, or it could be you. And there's nothing that can prevent that. There's no life and death on a razor edge the whole time. And so I tried to convey all of that.
I'm not an expert on war by any stretch of the imaginations, is war tactics have remained pretty similar throughout the many, many ages that we've been through. You know, we see wars in things like Game of Thrones. We see wars in, right through all of the wars, medieval, the whole flanking,
high ground,
all of
flanking,
the psychological
concentration
war,
of force.
That's still what, presumably, there's stuff like that is still happening right now in Ukraine. It's very similar.
But it's always been about also then how you apply the technology you have via those principles. So, battlefields are much more dispersed than they ever were. When you look at a thing like the Battle of Waterloo, which is like, I think it's 150,000 people crammed into sort of 5 fields, basically, all just smashing into each other until basically one army's destroyed or the other is. Now, you look at modern warfare, people are much, much more dispersed. They're hidden. The whole point is to sort of, not reveal what you're going to do. And essentially, and in the end, what it also comes down to is morale. And you've got to keep people going, and you've got to keep them engaged with what you're trying to do and how you do that. And the interesting thing in the Second World War is the British and their allies in the Dominions and the Empire and the Americans aren't dictatorships, so they don't have at their disposal the sort of levers of power that their enemies did, or that the Soviets did, where you could, someone didn't do as you're told, you'd shoot them. British and American armies and the Dominion armies weren't doing that. You couldn't do it because people had the vote. That's the big change in the Second World War. Citizen soldiers, citizen armies.
Amazing. Right, it's out now. Thank you. Go and get that. Presumably, have you done the audio book for it?
I've done the audio book for it as well. Yeah. It's in all amazing good bookshops and all that, blah, blah.
Perfect. Al, listen, thanks so much for joining us, mate. It's been an absolute pleasure and really, really enjoyed kind of chatting it with you. I'm so glad you're on board for this one as well.
Fantastic, though, isn't it? I mean,
it's so good. I can't even begin. I don't even know what to expect from next week. I just think I think we're just going to be left on an awful cliffhanger that's going to feel like it.
I think so.
I think it's just going to be a horrible cliffhanger because you just know that it's going to be 2024. It's going to be a long time.
Well, and who knows who's going to live or die? They've been very good with that. you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have. They have been very good with that, actually, yeah. And thank you to the book people as well for not giving it away. Remarkably unspoilt by the novel, which is good.
So. I think there's so little in the novel. You know, it's like an appendix of a fake history. So you don't really get what you got with Game of Thrones, where you had, like, people's perspectives on stuff. Yeah. Yeah. And I do think a lot of stuff, you know, obviously there could be spoilers about what happens, but, like, it's so hard to kind of be, to know exactly what happened because it's so up to interpretation in a way.
Amazing. Well, this is it, gang. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. Don't forget to like and subscribe and all that gibbons. Next week, as I said, we'll have this really good cool giveaway that HarperCollins have provided for us. Also, we'll go through, like, your plethora of kind of, like, emails and tweets and comments and stuff and try and answer as many questions as possible. But thanks for everyone that has been in touch. We really appreciate your support, especially if you joined us last week late after the Paddy interview. Feel free to go back and listen, because there's still plenty to dissect from all of the earlier episodes. And thank you also for lots of suggestions about how we can keep DragonCast going in the what will be an excruciatingly long break in between season one and season two of House of the Dragons. Lots of some really good ideas involving maybe picking up key episodes of Game of Thrones, maybe go back and doing a read-through of the books someone suggested as well, which was quite an interesting idea, read a chapter of the books and go through that. So we're going to work out a way, and hopefully by next week we'll have come up with an answer. But we're really pleased that you guys want us to keep going too. No pressure too. Yeah, if you're listening, producer Connell, get your fucking thinking cap on, son. Until then, I feel like I should end on a bit of an oath. So in the words of not Larry Strong, he's said and done enough. May the warrior give him courage. May the smith lend strength to his sword and shield. May the father defend him in his need. And may the crone lift her shining lamp and light his way to wisdom. Until next time, Dragoncast fans, Dracarys. Don't forget House of the Dragon airs exclusively on Sky Atlantic at 2 a.m. every Monday, then repeats that same evening at 10. You can also get it on demand via Now. If you'd like to get involved in the podcast, just head over to Twitter @DragonCast_pod or email DragonCast@daftdoris.com and leave us your Easter eggs, predictions and thoughts on the show. You can also watch this episode over on our YouTube channel. Just search for DragonCast Jamie East. Any support, whether it's a follow, a share, a mention to your friend on the bus or a tattoo on your backside, is very much appreciated. DragonCast is hosted by me, Jamie East, along with Chris Mandel, produced by Connor Driscoll, edited by Buddy Peace, and is a Daft Doris production. Dracarys.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.